From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation and Marquette University team up to focus on social innovation in the state.
Later, why some are closely watching the future of a hiking trail through a Milwaukee County park.
We have some plants where we have only literally one plant left of a rare plant or a species of concern. It is really important that people stay on the trail.
We'll hear a performance from Milwaukee singer-songwriter Micah Olson.
And Milwaukee Magazine's Ann Christensen brings us a guide to the best cocktails in Milwaukee.
It can be really daunting when you look at it from the very beginning and you think, how are we going to do this? Is this even doable? I would say there are so many more cocktails that this could have been a list of 100, I guess.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. The divide between Milwaukee and Madison is only 65 miles or so, but in many ways it seems much wider. The spirit of the two cities is often a study in contrasts between Milwaukee's business and manufacturing tradition and Madison's focus on government and academia.
But for a second consecutive year, a collaboration between institutions in each of the cities hopes to shine a light on innovative work that's happening across the state. The Force for Positive Change competition is a program organized by the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, or WARF, and Marquette University.
Kelsey Otero is the Associate Director for Social Innovation at Marquette, and Laura Heisler is Director of Programming for WARF. They joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio and explained why the mission of the program is a good fit for both institutions.
Well, I'll just start by saying that the vision underlying this effort really comes from John and Tasha Morgridge, who are tremendous benefactors to the state of Wisconsin, to the University of Wisconsin, and many other institutions and organizations across the state. And the vision and their hope, I think, is that we all recognize as a state that we have a future in inspiring young students, young innovators to work towards a better society, but to do it in a sustainable way. And so the hope is that businesses and nonprofits learn from one another about how to build really long-term vision that benefits people, the state, the economy, the environment, while still being a promising enterprise. And so there's a lot that we all have at stake as representatives of major universities and as citizens in trying to drive that kind of thing forward.
And so what makes it so compelling for Marquette?
We're a Jesuit university. This is what we've been doing for years. We are at city centers to help promote urban dialogue and create change. But this event and the awards are much larger than Marquette and Milwaukee. And I think this is a great example of collaboration across the state.
Right. There is something to the idea that this is not Milwaukee and this is not Madison,
right,
but
right.
It is Milwaukee and Madison working together.
And all of the rural areas, northern Wisconsin, eastern, and there's just so many different emerging markets and emerging ideas that are out there when we start to take a look at who's doing things really well and effectively across the state.
And we do have on our work team a number of representatives of organizations that have a statewide mission, like the Wisconsin Technology Council and the Wisconsin Campus Compact, and a number of groups that really look at the whole state and travel the whole state. And we're delighted to be able to tap into what they know and the partners they have.
Why was it so important to include both for-profit and nonprofit entities in this competition?
A lot of times folks are really staunchly in one camp, either for-profit or nonprofit, and we wanted to create a new way of thinking about what is that intersection that both of these groups have in common, and that is really solving a social problem at the end of the day. It doesn't matter if you are a for-profit, nonprofit, what your tax structure is, as long as you are a mission-driven organization that is focused on solving a social issue in a sustainable manner.
Do you think the two sides of the dynamic have something to learn from each other?
Absolutely.
I think that the vision behind this whole event and competition is to get them to look more like each other in a middle ground, and that what we're really trying to find are those organizations who are already thinking that way and have them talk to both sides of that divide, and hopefully more and more convergence will take place.
Well, can you talk about how the event and the program have evolved since their first incarnation?
Sure. So we've only done this one other time. So it's really living and breathing, and we're figuring it out as we go. We were asked to create something that would inspire everyone in Wisconsin, and yet also not just look at emerging ideas, but really recognize existing activity and celebrate existing strong activity. And so to get started, to be a successful competitor in the original competition, you had to have an up-and-going product on the market or good or a service. And so that was where we started. We really didn't know what there was in Wisconsin. And so the original competition just blew everyone away. We had almost 200 entries of organizations that were eligible to compete. And so even learning that as we went caused us to rethink as we head into the second one. What do we need to do? It's not a question of getting things started so much as raising the sophistication, creating connections, and making others, even outside of Wisconsin, aware of what's going on here so that they can be investors, partners, distributors, that kind of thing.
You had more than 200 entries. In the end, I think, four award winners
last
year.
Yeah, so it's really competitive, actually.
Well, right. but maybe the question then is, what was in it for the other 196 who perhaps didn't walk out of it with, you know, a cash grant, but who went through the experience?
Yeah, I think a few things came out of the event itself. So we had first the competition, and then we had a culminating event where we announced the winners. It was Academy Award style. You know, they didn't know if they were going to win. And so we wanted to make sure that the event itself had value for everyone and that they walked away feeling great, just as you're saying, that if they didn't win the cash prize, did they get something? So we created at the first event, we created sort of it was called a strolling supper. So it was sort of a showcase, and we had all of the finalists showcase what they had. They had sort of a table top display and an opportunity to talk to each other. And then we also invited a lot of investors and a lot of service providers who work with organizations like attorneys and accountants and others, so that they got a chance to make that sector aware of who they are and what they do, to meet one another, to meet potential investors. We also had at the event a few high-profile national organizations that really had a lot to teach these smaller companies. So, for example, we had Clif Bar, we had Organic Valley. So, and everyone really reflected on how valuable it was to hear from these established national profile organizations about what they do and to see the similarities and also make some connections. And actually, some of the companies acknowledged that they got some new business out of even just being at the event.
Can you talk about how getting the award was or potentially was not a game changer for the four companies that won last year?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, they know that they're in good company. This was not an easy award to win. A lot of them were able to take the funding that they received, as well as the recognition and some of the connections that came out of this, and leverage those to continue to grow their enterprises. A lot of them have brought in new business, new clients, and been recognized across the state and even outside of the state of Wisconsin as exemplar models for what social innovation looks like.
Presumably, there are some business owners or prospective business owners who are listening to this interview, but there are many, many people who are listening who are not. Can you talk about what is the overall, I guess, benefit to the community and the state at large from just the existence of this program?
One of the big things that I hear a lot from folks is, one, what is social innovation? And one of our hopes with this entire program is to bring social innovation into the conversation. And that's into the conversation that corporations are having, the social sector is having, as well as individuals. And I think that's an important part of changing the dynamic and helping us to better solve social issues within our own communities. The other big thing is to encourage organizations to look at ways to become sustainable. And I don't just mean environmentally sustainable. I mean financially sustainable, to rethink how are they bringing in money. So whether you're a nonprofit or for-profit, how are you bringing in money? And then how are you ensuring that you're not going to be reliant on grants or handouts or government donations? This is a new way for many organizations to think about doing business. So whether they're doing it before and applying, or they leave this program thinking about how can I continue to make a stronger impact within my community by being sustainable.
And one other thing I would add to those excellent points is that a lot of students know that they want to do something that matters. And as we hear more and more that the current young generation that's in school now or just recently out of school really has to be purpose and mission driven. And so the ability to think about doing that in a way that also taps into entrepreneurial spirit and gives them more control of their destiny is really appealing. And when we've had some events at UW-Madison that talk about social entrepreneurship that are student-focused, those are our best attended events of the year. There's just such an undercurrent of interest, curiosity, and excitement around that whole concept that you can have a purpose and a mission and possibly a career and possibly do well.
Well, and to that end, there are student categories in the competition this year, right?
Yeah, this is the first year that we've opened it up for students to apply, get recognized, and get some seed funds to continue to grow their ideas. And we've heard from students across the state that social innovation is really the direction that mm-hmm. they want to go, and we want to recognize and build on that.
Above that, the number of award winners for the broader competition is also expanding?
Yeah, so last year we had four winners, and we really didn't know going into it what we were going to see as categories. So we kind of made it up as we went. What were the strongest? who were the strongest competitors? And did they sort of segregate? And did the applications sort of segregate into some categories? And they sort of did. And then this year we decided to divide those a little bit, just a little bit more, and create some more affinity groups. And so we ended up with six categories that we think actually cover the range of enterprises that we saw last year. It will be interesting to see if there's something we didn't anticipate in the six categories. They're pretty broad.
Might have to have an at-large category.
Yeah, we might going forward. Yeah, that would be really interesting.
Well, and along those lines, can you remind us how the competition works?
Yeah, so currently, any individual or organization that is up and running is eligible to apply online. And to be eligible, entries must be an incorporated enterprise. And that means they can be for-profit or nonprofit. And there's separate applications for both of those. They need to be a revenue-generating organization. They need to be addressing a significant social and or environmental challenge in the state of Wisconsin. And they need to have staff based in Wisconsin. We're really looking at organizations and individuals who are creating a lasting impact in this state.
As you said, there were four companies that won awards last year. As you look back at them, what did those four companies, and maybe some of the others that entered but did not win awards, what did those entries have in common?
I would say the two distinguishing characteristics that come to mind for me were that they really had an articulated mission that focused on making Wisconsin better. And at the same time, they also had a strong business model for being able to do this and build on their idea sustainably and not have to rely on fundraising.
Peel back the curtain a little for us. Who was judging these entries?
We had a whole battalion of judges. So we had folks from Marquette, we had folks from UW-Madison, we had folks from other UW system schools. We had a number of practitioners in the community. So we had people in the legal community, people in the finance community, educators. We had a range of folks, and each application got looked at by at least two people in each of the stages. And we tried to pair people that came from very different walks of life. So maybe somebody from the Wisconsin Tech Council and someone from a university, that kind of thing, and really bring different perspectives. Any of these kinds of things is, there's a lot of eye of the beholder. So we tried to really have a robust system for scoring. And then where there was great discrepancy between the judges, we took it back to another group and really tried to, to overlay a lot of rigor on the process.
And I gather the event itself for the coming year is still a work in progress?
It is still a work in progress. We know we want to have some of the feedback we got last year was that we had too much and not enough time for people to rub shoulders and meet one another. So we want to make sure to build in some opportunities just for casual encounters. And then we also know from last year that we had such a spectrum of attendees, everyone from very established leaders of established companies that were in the, with finalists, as well as students. And that's a huge spectrum of sophistication in terms of understanding how to run a social enterprise. And so we want to have some breakout sessions that serve each part of that spectrum a little bit more intentionally so that everyone can find something of value as well as make connections across the divides.
Well, we will look forward to updating that story or updating this story as that event gets closer. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Laura Heisler is Director of Programming for WARF, which is the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. Kelsey Otero is Associate Director of Social Innovation at Marquette University. You'll find a link to more about the Force for Positive Change competition at WUWM.com. And we are in day three of our December membership drive. We are hoping to hear from 11 contributors this hour. Joy Powers is in the studio with me. I'm Bonnie North. You are listening to Lake Effect. And we are hoping to get the phones ringing. Joy, what is the number?
The number is 414-227-3210. As Bonnie mentioned, we are looking for just 11 donors this hour. And really, that funding allows us to bring you stories like the one we just had about WARF, about the effort to make both Milwaukee and Madison better cities, better places to live. And we really can't bring you those stories without your donations. So that number again is 414-227-3210, or you can head to our website. That's WUWM.com/give.
And today only, anyone who makes a contribution will be entered into a drawing to win four Paula Poundstone tickets her appearance is going to be this coming March 2018. I believe it's March 3rd. She's going to be at the Pabst Theater. She is screamingly funny. If you've ever heard her on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and other shows like that, or heard her live, she's been here a number of times. This is a great opportunity. It's an added extra incentive to hope that you might become one of the 11 donors that we need this hour to reach our goals. 414-227-3210 is the number. You can go to WUWM.com and make your donation that way. And you know, Joy, it doesn't matter. It can be $5, it can be $50, it can be $500. The important thing is becoming an active member of Milwaukee Public Radio.
Because you listen to WUWM, please donate. Number is 414-227-3210. And as Bonnie mentioned, you'll be entered with any donation. You don't have to donate, but because you listen, you should donate. That number is 414-227-3210. Did I not mention what you're going to be entered for? Because I believe I didn't.
I don't think you did, but... That's okay, because I will mention it is Paula Poundstone tickets. There are four of them on the line. Whoever wins it will get all four, so you can invite three of your closest friends and go and laugh for a couple of hours with Paula Poundstone in March. But you've got to be in it to win it, and that is really the name of the game. And like Joy says, because you are a listener, because you listen to Lake Effect, you listen to Morning Edition, you listen to Fresh Air, which is coming up after this show, maybe you're a Here and Now fan. Whatever you listen to, it's because you listen that you should be a donor if you are not already. And if you are, perhaps this is a perfect time for a year-end gift because it is tax season coming up very, very soon.
That's true. That number is 414-227-3210. You can head to our website, WUWM.com/give. And in just a moment, we'll learn about the uncertain future of a riverside trail in Milwaukee as Lake Effect continues on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee County's park system has long been referred to as a crown jewel in the area.
But keeping those jewels cleaned and polished is another issue altogether. Funding and staff are in short supply. One park with questions surrounding its future is in Milwaukee's River West neighborhood.
Pleasant Valley is nestled along the Milwaukee River's western shore. Lake Effect's Susan Bentz discovered recently that there's some tug and pull about the park's future, and she brings us this story.
I stumbled onto the Pleasant Valley Park story by accident during a meeting of the County Parks Energy and Environment Committee earlier this fall. I was there to hear about plans for another county park, but during the course of the meeting I heard...
Providing an informational report regarding the Pleasant Valley Park Trail. This item is informational only unless otherwise directed by the committee.
I'm happy to say this item coming to the committee per my request.
That's committee chair Supervisor Jason Haas. Pleasant Valley doesn't fall within his district, but Haas says he was struck by the 23-acre parcel along the river.
I've seen it. I've experienced it.
Long ago, Pleasant Valley was one of Milwaukee's most popular beer gardens. It featured restaurants, a band shell, steamboat docks, not to mention extravagant landscaping. Ramsey Radakovich is the deputy regional manager of the park's land resources division, and he brought the committee up to speed on the park today.
It's on the west side of the Milwaukee River, immediately adjacent to Kern Park, just to the south. This property is part of the bigger Greenway master plan.
The Greenway plan started taking shape a decade ago. It incorporates restored ecosystems along both shores of the Milwaukee River from North Avenue to Silver Spring and a 13-mile pathway for people to enjoy its renaissance. So far, a total of about 9 not yet contiguous miles of path exists. That includes Pleasant Valley. But as he showed the committee maps of the area, Radakovich says County Parks is concerned about the condition of its trails.
We have some existing concerns, road cutting of new trails and vegetation, unsustainable trail design, or just social trails lead to that, which lead to erosion and trail widening. Here are some examples. To the left, we have a fall line trail. Someone just took it upon themselves to either walk down and continually used, causing erosion, or the path of least resistance for water to do some scouring. Reviewing all the facts, an initial proposal we had, the red is the current trails. The blue ones were trails that we looked to add, and the pink ones were the ones that we were looking to close. The blue ones we talked about initially adding were to improve connectivity, but then also kind of tie it into loops. And
Mr. Radakovich.
Committee Chair Jason Haas.
So the blue trail, it's an idea?
Yes, it's a proposal.
It's a proposal then to make the new trail on the higher,
correct,
higher up on the bluff there. Is that a bluff?
Yes, there's a slope there.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I think that in particular has given some citizens some concerns.
Sure. So the other concern that was mentioned was the impact of vegetation. So as a trail builder, we don't always know what the best vegetation is or what are we trying to avoid. So we had our natural areas staff go out and kind of do a vegetation analysis where we envisioned the trail to go. They went through, they identified a couple pockets, and they talked about some plant communities.
Radakovich says he's mindful of native plants' importance in the parcel. He says the idea of cutting a new trail on higher ground was tabled until County Parks can figure out where it's safe to tread.
And we're back to the drawing board.
But people such as Sarah Faraj, who for years has hiked and fretted over the future of Pleasant Valley, seemingly in equal measure, are concerned their voices won't count when a final decision is made.
I've been down here just literally thousands of times. Mm. It's really quite amazing, the wildlife that you can see. Now, I'm down here usually with my dog on leash. Illegal to bring your dog off leash down here, which I used to do. I used to be guilty of, until I started realizing how much damage we are all causing down here. If we go off trail, if people are riding bikes down here, starting fires.
Yeah, we can smell it in the air.
Faraj wants to see the main trail that hugs the Milwaukee River to become the only path through Pleasant Valley. She points to threads, in some cases switchbacking between trees.
Look at how tall that tree is over there. That's well over 25 feet. I believe this is one of the largest trees. So unfortunately now we have a trail going right next to it. So here's another example of a trail created. After this trail was illegally cut, somebody cut this trail. And this is a very poorly cut trail. And it goes up very steeply over to the condos over there. And this soil is just incredible. And now it's gonna be, I can't even begin to guess what plants were growing here. But it's such a pity to see this. And actually, I'm going to, right now, pull some of this.
Faraj can't help herself. She begins tossing fallen branches and brush over the trail in an effort to hide evidence of the path so others won't tramp or ride bikes across it.
What happens when there's a trail up and down is you have people shortcutting more. We have some plants where we have only literally one plant left of a rare plant or a species of concern. It is really important that people stay on the trail, because we've already seen there are multiple plants that used to be here 5-10 years ago that are gone. They're gone. They've been cut up, they've been dug up by trail making, they've been stepped on too many times, and they're gone. Hey,
hi.
You know, there's no biking down here.
Really? As we stroll the main trail, a mountain biker catches up from behind. There's no biking allowed on either side of the greenway. There's a county ordinance that says so.
So you're not going to bike back down here again?
No, I'm going to go look at the county ordinance, see what I can do not do.
With that, the biker takes off, branches cracking and ruts forming beneath his tires. Faraj admits this section of the main trail has widened and is wet. That's one of the things County Parks points to as a problem. But Faraj thinks the weak spot can be mended without moving the trail altogether and putting more of the forest canopy and the fragile foliage beneath at risk.
The destination here is the river for a lot of people. They want to see the water. Some people want to sit by the river. They want to photograph by the river. They want to hear the sounds of the water running. They want to see the animals in the river, the ducks and the salmon running. So to close this off, you're taking away it's those sounds that we come down here to listen to.
I checked with Ramsey Radakovich with Milwaukee County Parks this week, and he reported that since the meeting took place, the county has, quote, an alternative route in mind that utilizes as much existing sustainable trail and minimizes the need to create additional trail. He says county park specialists will carry out a natural areas assessment next spring and summer. Then Radakovich says a public meeting will take place.
Here we have two off-leash dogs. Hi, pups.
For Like Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Three of them.
You can find information about the Milwaukee River Greenway Master, along with a bit more about the Friends Group determined to steward Pleasant Valley Park, at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee singer-songwriter Micah Olson has a new EP out today. Olson calls himself a one-man sound machine and says he consciously chooses capturing a moment rather than trying to achieve perfection.
We'll hear a full interview with him in the coming weeks, but ahead of an EP release tonight at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point, here he is in the Lake Effect Performance Studio introducing the title track from the record, Open Space.
This song is, it's more on my hippy-dippy side of thinking, but it's more a song about, you know, similarity as opposed to differences, and that's really it. I mean, the general idea is, through the song, is looking for common things that everybody goes through. I'm the ocean, the rivers and the stream. I'm a ladder, the bark, I am the tree. I could be you, you could be me. Speaking atomically. When we run out of tomorrow, please don't mourn the setting sun. It'll come back again. I'm a moment you hold inside your head that you relive any chance you can. And oh, well, I won't go quietly, only open space. Without sorrow, inside the game. Different face, different name.
Micah Olson performing the title track from his new EP, Open Space. The album gets an all-ages CD release party tonight at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point. Joining in the fun will be two other local bands, The Bellwether and Listening Party. We'll feature a full interview with Micah in the days to come. And right now, we're in the middle of our December membership drive. We're asking you to donate to WUWM, and we're looking for really just 11 donors this hour. So please become one of those donors. Our number is 414-227-3210, or you can head to our website. It's WUWM.com/give.
Like Micah Olson's CD release party tonight, this is an all-ages fun drive. Anyone who has access to a credit card, of course, can make a contribution of any amount. We are just hoping, because you are a listener and you value what you hear on this station, that you, if you have not already, will become a new member. And if you are already a member, perhaps you can consider an extra gift for the end of the year. And, Joy, one of the things that's great about Lake Effect is we get to showcase local musicians and musicians coming from all over the world here in our performance studio. And we have a terrific sound engineer in Jason Reavy. We have bands of all kinds, music of all genres being performed here, from classical to reggae to rap to folk, everything. And that is made possible, exactly that kind of thing is made possible by your contribution. And we couldn't do it without you, quite simply. And we know it's something that you value because you tell us that you love hearing that, and you might go to a concert that you never even knew you were interested in because you heard it here on Lake Effect on WUWM. So if that describes you, because you are listening and you say, wow, I didn't realize that my money went to pay for that, well, yes, it does. And thank you very much. We don't say it enough. Thank you so much to everyone who has made that possible. We're just hoping that you will be part of that as well. 414-227-3210 is the number to call. You can also go to WUWM.com/give.
As Bonnie mentioned, we can't do it without you. We couldn't do it without you. So please call us. We're looking for just 11 donors this hour. And if you call today and today only, you will be entered to win 4 tickets to see Paula Poundstone at the Pabst. She's coming into town Sunday, March 3rd. That's 4 tickets, you plus 3 friends plus 3 strangers plus 3 whomever.
3 cats, 3 dogs.
Well, I'm not sure that the Pabst,
they'll let dogs in.
certain dogs they're all right with. But people, mostly, you can invite along with you. And that's today only. So if you call 414-227-3210 or head to our website, wuwm.com/give, you will be automatically entered to win those tickets.
And that is a terrific thing. And you also know that you have supported the programming that you so depend on and that you enjoy here on Milwaukee Public Radio. And speaking of that programming, we're going to have one more break, and then dining critic Ann Christensen stops by the Lake Effect studio. She's going to share the cover story from this month's Milwaukee Magazine, which is the ultimate guide to drinking in Milwaukee. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect now on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. With a baseball team known as the Brewers and a nickname paying homage to the city's alcohol-fueled history, it should come as no surprise that Milwaukee is a big drinking town. So when the staff of Milwaukee Magazine sat down to hammer out their ultimate guide to drinking in Milwaukee, there were more than a few contentious categories.
Ann Christensen is the senior editor and dining critic at the magazine and one of the esteemed panelists judging the best cocktails in Milwaukee. Ann, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
For you, what are the defining features of a good cocktail?
Well, when we sat down and were trying to hash out just exactly those details, you know, we were thinking, well, gosh, there's so many things to consider here. I mean, do we find the definitive old-fashioned, the very best Cosmo, the best martini? And then we just sort of thought, well, no, let's not get super specific about certain types. Let's just look around for some of the most delicious and interesting and the really trailblazing types of cocktails, although you'll find some in this list that are along the lines of like an old fashioned, you know, might be a version of that. Or we have one that is, it's a tequila based drink that is not a margarita, but they use grapefruit juice, you know.
Yeah.
So these sort of more known types of cocktails, I guess, but people putting a different spin on them, you know. So it can be really daunting when you look at it from the very beginning and you think, how are we going to do this? Is this even doable? I would say there are so many more cocktails that this could have been a list of 100, I guess. But we kind of like narrowed it down to some of the really cool ones that are being done out there.
So the ones that are more inventive.
Yeah, right. I mean, maybe they're making their bitters in-house. They're doing infusions. I mean, the flavors are just really, really well balanced. So you know that you've got a mixologist or a bartender that really knows how to make a good tasting cocktail, something that really works. Has someone who has a great palate.
So as you said, you do have some old standards. You have like a Sazerac. You do have an old fashioned, I would guess, a pretty contentious category at the old fashions because
yeah.
People have such big opinions on them.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not a huge whiskey drinker, but
right.
I know like you can, of course, do it sweet. You can do it more sour.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose the old fashioned at the Jazz Estate?
First of all, they have three versions of an old-fashioned there. They do one that's based on the Bryant's version. Bryant's is their sister bar. They do a version that's rather a Wisconsin old-fashioned, which is a brandy old-fashioned, right? And that's sweet. And then they do one that's really off the wall that has coffee in it. To me, that's one of the most interesting old-fashions I've ever had. To me, I mean, Bryant's is like an institution. They're sort of that foundational place where they have these incredible people that create cocktails there. But those old-fashions are just really, really outstanding. I mean, you can go anywhere and get an old-fashioned. See, that's the real thing. I mean, like if you go to a bar and they've got brandy or they've got bourbon or they got whiskey and they got sweet or they've got a sour mixer or something, pretty much any of them can put that together and give you an olive or a maraschino cherry. But if somebody's really putting some thought into this, that's what we were looking for, hence the Jazz Estate. I mean, I know this is probably fighting words for a lot of people because, as you said, it's such a complex topic. And in fact, we did our own rating of the best old fashions. We had not in this story, but two
yeah.
categories, sweet and sour. And that was a story we did like a year ago. And we are sort of like posting the results of that again on our website, and it went mad on traffic. I mean, people just went crazy. So there clearly is an interest in that, and everybody does have an opinion. But, you know, try the Jazz Estate. It's really interesting. Because the way I look at it with that version is if you're going to do Korbel and you're going to do, you know, the sweet mixer and you're going to have the cherry, okay, that's kind of standard. It's hard to really, like, do anything different with that. But they've got three versions, right? They've got the sour, and then they do this one where they're really trying to push it a little bit with the coffee. So, I don't know. I give them a lot of credit for that. I think it's a really cool thing they're doing.
Yeah. What are some of the more inventive cocktails that ended up on this list?
Well, when we were first looking at cocktails, one of the places we were looking at was Dock 18, which is a really interesting little cocktail lab that was run by the Bitter Cube guys. They do this whole line of Milwaukee-based bitters. They have now taken that on the road and are doing a pop-up version of this. If you ever have the opportunity to go to a pop-up event that's run by Bitter Cubes, Dock 18, do it. Because these guys are, I mean, they're not only using their own bitters, but they're using really interesting botanicals, infusions. They might be lighting something on fire. There's so much thought and effort and creativity put into a cocktail. However, that isn't the only thing that we looked for in a cocktail. You know, for instance, what was nice about this list is the Cosmo at Elsa's. We included that. I don't think they've changed the recipe in, I don't know, 30 years. But those people, they nailed that cocktail. They just crushed it. I mean, that Cosmo is like the perfect Sex and the City Cosmo. I mean, you're not going to find another one like it. I was really into, there's a restaurant and bar in the Shorecrest Hotel called Supper. They do a lot of like retro style cocktails. That's the real trend here, is this idea of retro. And even when you, if you look at the spread that we do, you know, everything's kind of served in these old tumblers or those old champagne glasses. There's such an interest in that now, in that old, that very 1950s, 1940s idea of cocktails, and even into the 60s and 70s, into the Harvey Wallbangers and things like that. Supper has this really interesting take on, well, they have a number of different retro cocktails. This particular one is called a New York Sour. But what's really interesting about it is they use this Old Forester bourbon, and it's mixed with lemon and then sweet sour. They add red wine to it. And the way they mix this cocktail, the red wine floats on the top of the glass. But before you drink it, you use your straw and you kind of stir it up. There's something just really amazing about what happens to those flavors once you stir them up. So I don't know. That's an example of something that's a little bit more retro, but they're using their own idea, what red wine they want to use, the sour mix that they like, the bourbon that they like. So it adds sort of an interesting blend to it.
As you said, there are a lot of these retro cocktails that ended up on the list.
Yeah.
And when we talk about wine, we so often talk about like old world wine and new world wine. Mm-hmm. Is there an old world cocktail and a new world cocktail? Are there big differences in yeah. the more modern cocktails versus the older ones?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, they say that the Sazerac is one of the oldest cocktails ever created, like in the early 1800s in New Orleans. And we do have a Sazerac on this list. I'm a fan of them. I think they're just really classic and not too complicated. They have a little bit of absinthe on the rim. The more modern cocktails, I guess, in my opinion, seem to be oftentimes reinterpretations of old cocktails.
Okay.
Because I think it's hard to get away from, first of all, you're going to start with the main spirits, you know, vodka, whiskey, gin, you know, and then you're going to have your kind of ancillary spirits that you're going to mix with it, and then maybe a sweet and sour, something along those lines. I think maybe the one thing about modern cocktails is maybe some of the different ways that people are infusing them, you know, whether they're infusing the spirits with some sort of flavor or a fruit or an herb, or they're making an atomizer and spraying something in there. And then people are lighting things on fire, or they're using smoke sticks to actually add sort of this, like almost a cedar smell to it. So I think that's what makes the modern. I think it's some of those flourishes. That's, to me, what defines it. I think the classic ones are the old ones. They don't have a lot. Like a Negroni, to me, it was like dominated by this is Campari. You know, it's just, it doesn't need a lot of flourishes or bells and whistles. I think, you know, I'll probably get someone shooting me down for this, but I do think the modern cocktails tend to have a little bit more of the bells and whistles.
What were some of the more, as you were going through the different cocktails, what were some of the more contentious picks that made it onto the list, just among your staff?
Yeah, we definitely had ones that dropped out, and we definitely had ones that we debated. For instance, like a Moscow Mule. I'm not even sure that part of me sort of thought, well, you know, a Moscow Mule is essentially, you know, ginger beer and vodka. It's not that unusual, right? Clearly, you want it served really cold. You want, you know, the right amount of lime juice in it. You want some fresh mint in there. It should be served in a copper mug. So we debated inserting a classic like that on the list when a lot of people will do a Moscow Mule and a lot of people will do it well. And they'll do it in the very classic way and it's served exactly the way it's supposed to. But the person that actually had that particular Moscow Mule, I think, made a really good argument for it because it's at Great Lakes Distillery and it uses their vodka. They used a very specific ginger beer. I mean, everything about it was kind of Milwaukee-ized. So I think that one was a situation where we thought, okay, that makes it a little more unusual. It isn't just your basic vodka. It isn't Tito's or something. It isn't, you know, Absolut and then with, you know, some kind of random ginger beer. This one is really localized. And I think that made it more legit, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah, and the ginger beer is made, as I said, it's made locally by Top Note Tonics, which makes this has this great line of tonics too.
The article itself or the piece itself is really far-reaching. You get into, you know, the best beer bars, you get into the best wine shops, you get into a lot of different categories, really all revolving around drinking. One of the more unusual ones that I picked up on was you had a whole piece on the Tom and Jerry. And when I mentioned this to my colleagues, many of whom are from the East, they went, I don't know what that drink is. For people who might be in the audience and might not know a Tom and Jerry.
A Tom and Jerry, I mean, I guess until we had our, we have a guy who writes about cocktails for us. He's from Milwaukee, but he's actually a nationally known cocktail expert. I didn't realize that the Tom and Jerry was a Wisconsin thing, but I grew up with a grandma that always had punch bowls. And I think that's one of the telltale signs that maybe someone entertained in your family and had made a Tom and Jerry. But I didn't realize how common it was in Wisconsin because I'm not accustomed to drinking cocktails that have eggs and sugar and cream and are served warm like that and have booze in them and are served during the holidays. But it's sort of like a hot toddy. Once it starts getting cold, people love it. This particular drink is very similar to eggnog, except it's boozy and it's served warm. So you're going to drink it in a mug, and there are actually different explanations how it actually got its name. And some people think of Tom and Jerry, the cartoon characters. I mean, I think there are stories everywhere. Where did this actually come? And I don't know if there is a definitive explanation for where it came from. So this particular story was a little bit about the author reminiscing about his own experiences with it. Let's say you know it's the holiday season now and we're almost into winter and you want to go get one. Where do you go? Where can you get a really traditional one? You know, you can go to the Packing House, which is like this very classic kind of supper clubby steak place right by the airport, or you can go someplace like the Phoenix Cocktail Lounge, which is over on Jefferson, very modern. They're doing some really interesting, very, for lack of a better word, avant-garde cocktails, but they do a traditional Tom and Jerry's. So it's one of those things where I think, yeah, maybe if you're not from Wisconsin, kind of like if you're not from Wisconsin, you think, why would I drink a Wisconsin old fashioned? Why would I want that? It is what it is. Does it sound appealing to you, this sort of boozy
eggnog? I've had a Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
My mom actually will buy the batter around Christmas.
Oh.
You can buy a batter, a ready-made batter for a Tom and Jerry. My mom, who doesn't actually drink, will make them.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. They're interesting. I don't know. It's definitely a unique cocktail.
Yeah.
And indicative, I would say, of the cocktails. I mean, you mentioned, of course, as we have a lot in this conversation, old fashions. A lot of the Wisconsin cocktails do seem to skew sweet.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Tom and Jerry definitely fits into that category.
Rich and sweet. Yeah. I remember the first time I had hot buttered rum and I thought, I don't know about this. This is like, and I don't know that I want more than one of these, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very, almost like a special occasion drink. But, you know, like I said, that's a very, like, locked in time type of cocktail, I think. I mean, what your mom is doing is very, I think that's very retro, like 40s, 50s, you know what I mean? And would she serve it in a punch bowl? Would she do that?
She doesn't because she's generally making it for me and my sister.
Oh, okay. So not for a crowd.
Not for a crowd.
Okay.
But I think she has. I think at parties she's made a large kind of vat of Tom and Jerry's.
Yeah.
All right. So if you're looking for a Tom and Jerry,
yes,
you have a lot of options in Milwaukee.
Or Tom and Jerry's, which I keep wanting to say for some reason. I don't know. I mean, I think it is singular, a Tom and Jerry. So there you go.
But if you have multiple.
Right.
All right. Well, Anne, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Ann Christensen is a senior editor and dining critic at Milwaukee Magazine. For more on their ultimate Milwaukee drinking guide, you can head to WUWM.com. And while you're there checking out the ultimate drinking guide, before you have any of those drinks, make sure that you make a contribution to WUWM. It is our December membership drive, and we are very close to getting our 11 donors this hour. That is our goal, and we are hoping that if you are not already one of those 11, that you become one of those 11. And Joy, how do they do it?
All you have to do is go to WUWM.com/give, or you can call us at 414-227-3210. It really just takes a minute in either case, just a minute, and you get to fund the great radio that you expect from us. You know, you listen to WUWM because we bring you stories like the best cocktails in Milwaukee. There's really no other place that you're going to hear that same conversation. Stories about your neighborhood. Stories about things that are happening in your backyard. We bring you voices from your community. We bring you the voices of your neighbors. But we can't do that without your help. So please call us, 414-227-3210, or head to our website, WUWM.com/give.
One of the things that we do in order to tell all of those stories is we have these partnerships across different kinds of journalistic organizations, and the Milwaukee Magazine is one of them. We do this with the Journal Sentinel, with the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, with the Business Journal. We have folks come in who have special beats that they cover and tell us about things that we, our little staff of four, can't get out and do ourselves, but then we take their expertise and we offer it to you. And that is one of the things that you are paying for when you make a contribution to Milwaukee Public Radio by calling 414-227-3210 or by going to WUWM.com. And, you know, Ann Christensen is one of the leading dining critics in the city, and it's so great that she comes in here every month to talk about favorite restaurants, favorite this, favorite that, and in this case, the ultimate Milwaukee drinking guide, because, of course, you know, you've got to have that in Milwaukee.
It's really invaluable, but we are putting a value to it. We need your donations in order to bring you those conversations. I'll say, after my conversation with Anne, I went out to a bar. I tried a new cocktail that had been suggested, and it was amazing. It was amazing to have her expertise in informing, you know, that part of my life.
And it informs your life, and that is why you listen to Milwaukee Public Radio. There's room for very serious policy discussion. There's room for musicians. There's room for drinking guides. It's everything that you could possibly want in a show on Lake Effect and on Milwaukee Public Radio. And so this is your opportunity. Get yourself into that drawing for the Paula Poundstone tickets. That's today only. Somebody will win it at the end of the day. We hope it's you. But you have to call 414-227-3210 or WUWM.com.
As Bonnie mentioned, we do have four tickets available to Paula Poundstone, but you have to donate today. The number is 414-227-3210. And Bonnie, I believe that's today's edition of the show.
I think it is. And I'm Bonnie North.
I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.
With cocktails for two.